some old quizzes and some quizzes from the idiot. I'll leave them out here for the end of class. Let me just say that our conferences have been going well. My schedule's filled up for tomorrow. Is there anybody that has not seen me and isn't on the schedule to see me tomorrow?
Me.
Okay.
I sent you an email. I don't know if you got it.
Oh.
Because I had to cancel my appointment on Wednesday.
Okay. Okay. So, well, I'll reply to you as well.
Okay.
I'm sort of vaguely scheduled for Friday. There wasn't a slot that I could make.
Nathaniel?
Yeah.
But it's going to have to be after 3. You know, do you think that we could, you could email me?
Yeah.
Instead, about your idea, and we'll work right that way, because I don't think I can be there at 3.
Okay.
But my regrets. Everybody else, it's been a nice personal encounter, except for me and the and looking at the syllabus, I see what it is that's making you all, giving you such pressure to be so full of good ideas. We have a deadline of November 24th. That's just 12 days away. One of you astutely pointed out to me. That's not good enough time. Let's make it a week more. I know your Thanksgiving hosts will curse me, but because it'll darken your weekend, but that's okay with me.
We will love you forever.
I will take upon me that blame. December 1st. We'll make it through December 1st, and you'll also have to read some Tolstoy. But we won't quiz you that day. Will we? Yeah, we will.
Well, maybe we should let the axe fall a little later.
We'll let that slide for a little bit. So that's my announcements. Now, we want to continue then on the podium with Dr. Dupree's ideas, where we'll pick up from where he left off last week.
All right. Well, as I was telling Dr. Cohen just a few minutes ago, I looked up polydigmatic, I Googled, and I Binged, and I OED'd, and I was delighted. Returned no results anywhere. It is not a word yet. But it is now. It is spoken by some 30-plus people. You don't have to use it, by the way. It's just a convenience. Now, let me review very quickly a few things. So first of all, we had the fourfold method. And one of the ways of looking at the fourfold method is to say that a story can be told from different perspectives. You can zoom in or out. You can look at the external facts of a story, or you can look at what's happening internally. You can look at a story as the story of something happening on a large scale or a small scale, involving one person or a whole community as a character, perhaps, and so on. So these are the fourfold method, then, tells us that a story exists on different registers, a narrative does. And each of these registers can in turn be like a layer that has direct connections as a kind of overlay on each layer. Now, there's another way of looking at this, and it's what I would call the Plutarchan model from the Bioi Paralleloi, the parallel lives, sometimes translated as lives of the noble Greeks and Romans. And you know, of course, that one of Plutarch's works is a collection of 23 parallel lives of Greek figures from history and Roman figures. Well, some of them are from mythology. For example, Theseus, founder of Athens, Romulus, founder of Rome. The point of the parallel lives is partly to show what moral virtues, what qualities each of these figures had in common, and therefore to show how they're parallel in their actions. By and large, what Plutarch is interested in is establishing a kind of moral model of someone worth imitating for what he does. However, he also bears in mind that it might be of some help to choose models who are not necessarily good, but who are instances of evil, and so on. And so we have Plutarch in the ancient world. Then we have, of course, the Imitatio Christi, that is paralleling our own lives with the life of Christ, and so on and so forth. We have the Bible, and we've talked about the apocalyptic imagination, and that's another way to organize a plot in a certain fashion. And so the apocalypse then is an episode in the entire story that the Bible tells about mankind and mankind's relationship to the divine and so on and so forth. Now, there's another model that is an interesting aspect of the polydigmatic. So here, you notice the fourfold method is one way of reading the Bible, but the Bible itself then can be a paradigm for various events in history, or can influence history in certain directions, because it acts as a divine model for human endeavor, or it acts as a divine model for human history, and therefore as a way of understanding human history. But now I get to something somewhat less grandiose, and that's the invention in the course of the 19th century, in fact, exactly contemporary with Dostoevsky's first fiction, and continuing to develop, and it reaches its first maturity just as Dostoevsky is reaching his first maturity. And it's a very interesting variant of the polydigmatic, and that is the detective story. And guess what? By the time the Brothers Karamazov is published in 1880, then the modern detective story is up to its Sherlock Holmes phase. And I don't want to go into detective fiction very much. We'll look at some of this in relation to the three interviews between Smerdyakov and Ivan Fyodorovich a little bit later here. So I'm going to assume you're up to at least 605 or so. That is, you've read through chapter 8. That's 601 in the Norton edition. And it's chapter 9 in part, gosh, I can't remember, part, book 11, chapter 9 in book 11.
What's the title?
The title, well, I'm not going to assume you've read The Devil, Ivan Fyodorovich's Nightmare, but this, the last interview with Smerdyakov. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Could you go over quickly what you mean by polydigmatic?
Ah, you missed last time.
No, I didn't.
No, I'm going No, you did. You were here, but you were somewhere else. Probably. No, I'm sorry. I'm just joking. I don't mean that. I would not impugn your integrity for the world. All right. Let's see what we're doing here. All right. So just as the polyphonic in Dostoevsky does not allow any single voice to dominate, so that we have to take all the voices together, and I don't know what we arrive at. It depends on the structure of the novel, perhaps an average of all the voices, or perhaps we have a dialectic between two people that creates a kind of sum of oppositions, and we have a kind of thesis-antithesis that arrives at a synthesis. This is the polyphonic, so multiple voices, none of which is necessarily the absolute reference for everything else, none of which dominates so exclusively that we can say the truth lies in this character and what he says. He represents the author, and the author is the truth. So Dostoevsky doesn't do that. No character represents the author. Some characters, perhaps, say things that the author said, but that doesn't mean that they represent the author. Everything anybody says can be and is countered by something somebody else says. All right, so that's Bakhtin's understanding of the polyphonic, and its opposite is the monologic, where one voice controls and dominates everything and all other voices are subordinate to it, okay? Now, my idea, and I claim credit for this, but I'm prepared for somebody to say, oh, that's such an old idea, you know, this was written about by critic so-and-so in 1901. It always happens. Nothing is absolutely new. But anyway, I thought, what on the level of narrative is the equivalent of the polyphonic? And so I came up with this term, polydigmatic, from degmatikos, which in Greek means model, or degmatika, which means just a straightforward narrative or story. Dia in Greek, going straight through, and so on. So this term has been used in recent criticism in relation to words similar to it, like the diegetic and so on, as a description of narrative. But we also have this term in English, paradigmatic, and the digmatic comes from the same Greek word. All right, so I'm going to call it polydigmatic, meaning exactly the same. We have a multiplicity of narratives going, not just a different narrative for each character, but sometimes multiple narratives within one character. And that's where it gets really interesting.
Uh-huh. What relation does this have to T.S. Eliot's idea of tradition?
Oh my gosh. I'll be happy to go there some other time. But
it's a very interesting question. Eliot says that tradition, in a nutshell, tradition is a body of works, but it's a body of works that still remains part of our discourse and our literary memory, and that they form a whole, a related whole, and that when a new work is added to that body of works, it changes the way we see all the works in it. So the individual talent comes in and actually changes the way. So T.S. Eliot writes The Wasteland, that changes the way we read Homer.
Well, I just heard multiple narratives.
Yeah.
So.
Well, here's the question. If multiple voices, then, if you can't say what the story, if you can't say what's being said without taking all the voices into account and all their conflicts and their agreements and their variations, then you can also say the same thing in Dostoevsky's novels. Increasingly, till we get to the brothers, we can say we have now multiple narratives, and no one narrative is the whole story. What is the story here? Is it Alyosha's adventures? Is it Dmitri's? Is it Ivan's? Is it Smerdyakov's? Is it, well, you know, name, oh, your favorite dozen or 20 so characters in Brothers Karamazov, because there are plenty to go, enough to go around. So I want to experiment with how this works. Now, last time we looked a little bit at Grushenka, and we noticed that Grushenka is playing two stories simultaneously in that chapter, in which Katerina Ivanovna thinks she has got Grushenka into her narrative, and that Grushenka is going to play the role assigned to her in her narrative. She's this wonderful, this fantastic woman, and what Grushenka does at the very moment when Katerina Ivanovna thinks everything is just right, she refuses to follow the narrative. She's got her own narrative. And suddenly, Katerina Ivanovna is the captive of Grushenka's narrative. Now let me ask you a couple of questions here. What is Ivan's narrative?
The Grand Inquisitor?
Yes. And I mentioned this last time. In The Grand Inquisitor, Ivan says, I want my narrative. I reject God's narrative. Do you want to say something?
Sorry. I was just going to say rebellion.
Yeah, but basically, it's a refusal to accept the existence of evil, a certain kind of evil, innocent suffering. Ivan's world is one that does not allow innocent suffering. And,
Is that to say that Ivan has a narrative besides just rebellion? I mean, that's kind of my problem, my question when I read those two chapters.
Yeah.
Is it just, what is he offering instead of, he's rejecting God's world, but then what's his narrative?
Well, how long does he think he's going to be in action? Until he's 30. He hasn't planned beyond that. See, he doesn't have a story beyond 30. Does he mean he's going to commit suicide? We don't know. We just don't know. He hasn't thought beyond 30. That's it. By the way, where does your narrative stop? Now, I'm quite serious about this. Think about it for a moment. Where does your narrative stop? You see, surely you're not thinking about what you're going to do when you're 80, are you?
Sometimes.
Really?
I think I want to be alive when I'm 80, but not much beyond that.
You don't want to be much beyond?
No, I don't think about much,
yeah.
Except I hope I live to be 80 or 90 something.
But then you can imagine stories of being 80 or 90 that wouldn't be so good.
Oh, yeah.
Blind, deaf, crippled.
That's true.
You know, bad heart. Think of all these things. Okay. Yeah, so you see, there's a cutoff point for these things. We can only imagine so far. Do people imagine scenarios in the course of the Brothers Karamazov? All the time, don't they? Okay, so if Ivan's story of the world, see, this is not Ivan's story of himself. This is the master narrative, what we tend to call the master narrative. A world in which there is no innocent suffering. This will give meaning for Ivan to the world, and it will tell him what his role is in it.
Mm-hmm. I just have a question of whether the polytechnic would include the narratives the author maybe, but especially the readers put on characters, and the trajectories we shape for as we read along.
Ah. Well, that's an interesting thing that I hope to talk about, not today, because there's not time, but you remind me of it, okay? Eventually. It's a very interesting book that was published first in Italian. In fact, I read it in Italian in the mid-70s, called Structures in Time by Cesare Segre, an Italian critic, very good one. And he, in a long introductory chapter to that, he talks about, in one section of it, he says that when we read a book, we compose what he calls una sintesi memoriale, a memorial or a memory synthesis. And our reading of the book proceeds according to what we remember from earlier parts of it, and as we remember these earlier parts, we construct what we expect the narrative to do next. And that's a great segue to my next point, which is the detective story. All right, so there's some argument about who created the first detective story. It's usually Edgar Allan Poe's Murders in the Rue Morgue, or the case of Marie Roget and his inspector Arsène Dupin. But there is a detective in Dickens' Bleak House. So this is, that's about, what is that, 1840, 41, when we get Murders in the Rue Morgue. Then 1854, I think, is Bleak House, Dickens, and he's got Inspector Bucket. The whole of Bleak House is not a murder mystery, but there is a detective and an investigation of a mystery, so to speak, that goes on inside that novel. And then his friend and disciple, Wilkie Collins, wrote The Moonstone Woman in White in the 1860s, and these are bona fide examples now, detective novels or mystery novels of that sort. All right, so now what's going on in those? What happens in a mystery novel? By the way, we are constructing, right now, as a group, we are constructing what polydigmatic means. We are creating literary criticism and theory, right here. See? This is not prepackaged, like all this other stuff. We're making it. We're being polysemiotic, I guess, or something. Okay, so, occurred to me, look, see if this thing is actually recorded, since this is a one-time event. All right, so what happens in a detective novel? I don't know, choose something kind of typical, maybe Miss Marple or...
Someone dies.
Huh?
Someone gets murdered.
Somebody gets murdered. Yeah. There's a given for you. And I don't know if you've ever, Monsignor Ronald Knox, who was an aficionado of murder mysteries and detective stories, had wrote up a list of 10 commandments of the detective story. And one of them is the murderer cannot be a Chinaman. So, but anyway, they're all, it's an amusing thing. You can find it online somewhere if you're interested. So, I'm not interested in the detective novel as a minor literary structure with its formulae and all this. It's highly formulaic. What I'm interested in is what happens paradigmatically, or I'm sorry, polydigmatically here. So, what goes on in a detective novel? What is the relationship of the stories?